This is Fresh Ed, a weekly podcast that makes complex ideas and educational research easily understood. I'm your host, Will Brehm. Today we are going to air a conversation I had with Bruce Collette, the editor of the journal Diaspora, Indigenous, and Minority Education. DIME, as the journal is known, has an interesting series called Conversations, where Bruce interviews academics in the field. The interviews are transcribed, edited, and published in their journal. We thought it would be great to air the full conversation on Fresh Ed, and that's what we're going to do today. The edited version of the interview will be published in the next issue of DIME. I'll be sure to share a link once it's out. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Will Brehm, so great to have you, and I just want to thank you once again for joining us here.
Thanks so much, Bruce, for having me.
We always begin our interviews for the conversation series with the same basic question, which is, what are the major issues facing the education of diasporic, indigenous, and or minority communities today? So we'll begin with that very large question, and then we'll allow the conversation to go where you would like it to go.
Thanks, Bruce. It is a big question, and for someone who doesn't sort of formally do research in that space, it's rather hard to unpack in a way and try and find my own entry point into it, having thought a little bit about it. You know, I think there's a big question around what knowledge counts as being valid. And I think some of the communities that your journal is particularly interested in are often on the sort of end of having knowledges that don't count within sort of the academic space. And I think that's a really unfortunate state of affairs. And what I hope with some of my own work and even some of the podcasting that I've done, you know, is to sort of push what we mean by valid knowledge in new ways. And I think communities, diasporic communities, ethnic minorities, these are groups that probably have a lot to offer when we rethink what it means to be valid, have valid knowledge, or what knowledge systems matter, or different ways of thinking and being.
For sure. And I think that is a very good entry point. In fact, you are correct. Our journal has increasingly, I think, seen such entries as indigenous ways of knowing or indigenous pedagogy, indigenous schooling, for example. But there's a concerted effort, I think, right now within the field, and particularly within our indigenous communities, our indigenous scholars, to have their voices heard and represented, which tells us something, right? It tells us that the ontologies that have been circulating for a long time within the field are not mapping on to the ways in which many of our brethren, you know, experience social reality. Perhaps we can talk a bit about that then, if you will, comparative education as a field and where it started and where it's gone and the kinds of ontological spaces and epistemological spaces that we need to revisit or open up. Because I know you've done a fair amount of work in just looking back at the history of our field and what counts as valid knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always important to go back into history to try and understand how we got to where we are in a way. And I think that, you know, history really shapes the present. I don't know if it determines where we're going to go in the future, but it certainly shapes it and maybe limits option where we're going. And I think, you know, I love seeing more and more sort of indigenous ways of being and knowing featuring in academic research. And for me, it's a really great shift of late. But I think you also see things where people are using that language in ways that maybe are a bit disingenuous or sort of riding the zeitgeist, you know, the academic zeitgeist, decolonizing everything, but then not really living up to what it actually means to decolonize. Or things like valuing difference, but having it very superficial. The reason we, you know, have multiculturalism is so we can try different foods or, you know, acknowledge that people dress differently. And I think hopefully we can get a little bit beyond that in some of our thinking. Now, historically, of course, the field of comparative education sort of comes out of, you know, I would say the structures of the field of comparative education when it actually sort of became a field of study rather than, you know, just sort of learning from others during your travels about education, but actually saying, okay, there's something called the field of comparative education, and let's start creating some sort of infrastructure. I think Bob Cowan called it an infrastructure of conferences and of journals and, you know, of meetings and associations and people would start having, you know, positions in universities that said comparative education. When those things started happening, you know, it was happening in a particular moment in time in the US and in the UK and sort of the world at large, where power was trying to be sort of projected internationally in certain ways. And education, in many ways, was a tool for that power, right? And so us as comparativists were sort of working within that context, even if we didn't necessarily agree with the way it was being operationalized, like how that tool of power was being used.
Let's put a timestamp on that, Will.
Yep. So the U.S., a lot of this, you know, so we're both in the field of, or we both are members of the society, the Comparative and International Education Society. And so that society started in the 1950s. And it was really in that moment, sort of the post-World War II moment, when in the U.S. space, the field of comparative education really sort of institutionalizes. Now, of course, there were people, particularly in the UK, who were working in the space of comparative education sort of before this, but this is when I would argue that it really sort of becomes quite concrete.
Okay, well, there's a lot of stuff happening in the 1950s and that immediate post-World War II period of time. There's a lot to untangle there. And, you know, I do want to cycle back to what it actually means to decolonize the curriculum, for your words earlier. But let's dig in a little bit to the 1950s and the immediate post-World War II era. This is, after all, the advent, really, of what becomes the Cold War, both geopolitically, but also you use the phrase cultural Cold War in one of your pieces. And I know we can certainly talk a lot about the anti-communist strand evolved within the field. But let me just open that up to you. What are some key points or key moments within the immediate post-World War II period for comparative education that had particular consequences for indigenous, diasporic, or minority peoples? And I know it's a large bucket there, so you can just choose one or two examples, you know, perhaps. Yeah,
you definitely can approach this from so many different ways. You know, maybe thinking about it in terms of sort of what discourses really started to emerge. And now some are perhaps relatively new discourses, and then some are probably older discourses around education that sort of just get repurposed. So some, you know, the big one probably from this point is where lots of scholars have shown how economic thinking really sort of enters the public policy space at this point. And I interviewed a woman named Elizabeth Pop Berman, who wrote a whole book called Thinking Like an Economist. And she documents a lot of these changes that happened. Now, in education, a lot of this comes around the integration of the economics of education into policy discourses and things like human capital theory, which is still a big topic of, or a big theory that people use and criticize and write about in our field and beyond. It emerges in the 1950s out of the University of Chicago, Theodore Schultz, and then sort of just, it sort of really explodes in the 1960s, 1970s, and, you know, to this very day continues to be used by institutions like the World Bank that use it as a way of justifying investments in education. More broadly, what we see is, you know, this discourse of investing in education as being sort of commonplace, like you must invest in your education, states must invest in education of citizens, or I should say in the opportunity for citizens to have education. And this is where some of the communities your journal is concerned with really come in. You know, what does it mean to be a member of a community that's the state is investing in its citizens to have opportunities for education? Are those opportunities equally shared among all the people in that community? Do you have to be a citizen to receive said education? But it goes further, right? Because I think some of the discourse around, say, human capital theory, which would suggest, you know, the policy advice that really came out in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s was really about the state should invest in general education and leave basically higher levels of education to fees. The individual should invest on their own because of the rate of return. The social rate of return was higher for general education than it is for higher education. And more importantly, the private rate of return in terms of someone's personal income is really high for higher education. And so therefore, if you want that premium, you should go and invest yourself, take the risk, take out the loan, whatever it is. And one of the consequences that this has had, I just was reading this in this really great article in the New Left Review, where the author was saying, if you look in the US at discrimination in employment, right? It's illegal to discriminate against someone who is of a different race, illegal to discriminate against someone who is of a different religion or if a different gender, right? They have all these provisions for stopping discrimination in employment. Except one, you're allowed to discriminate if the person has a credential or not, right? And it sort of feeds into this notion that investing in education is so commonplace and assumed that if you don't do it, you actually could be not hired by a company, even though we know that having a credential doesn't necessarily mean you have the skills ready to do that job. And so this goes back to ethnic minorities or diasporic communities or indigenous populations or, you know, refugees that are moving, right? They might not have the credential, and so therefore would be not allowed to have that job or whatever it is.
Yeah, or even going with respect to what you're speaking before about the fact that our earlier, you know, studies of rates of return found that, well, it was really, we get our most rewards, right? We get our highest rate of return at the primary level. Mm. We're going to leave the higher education essentially as a kind of open market, and whether you can afford to or whether you can, then it's really right. Based on your own incentive, but we shouldn't forget the poor are also a minority group. And of course, those without economic resources, these populations overlap. So it's very often the case that minoritized communities by race, ethnicity, status, right, state status, also are under-resourced, many times not at all because of their own doing, but because of larger structural systems of exploitation and whatnot. So yes, I absolutely see how this can trace its way back to the kind of competition for credentials that it's unevenly stacked, right? I mean, you know, your chances of, if you're a refugee and your education's been splintered because you've been in transit for, you know, 15 of the last 30 years of your life, it's much harder to put together the kind of track record.
Or it could also be, you know, you do have all the credentials, they're just from the wrong institutions. Right. They're not recognized as being valid. You know, I have friends who have done degrees in Iran, and it's like, go to the UK, and it's like, you're going to have to do that again. We don't recognize that particular degree. And so I think it's credentials, but it's also the status of that credential. Where does that credential come from? And you see a power imbalance for sure.
For sure. And in talking about a kind of imbalances of power. And sometimes people are wrongly empowered to make those kinds of decisions. Like, I'm not necessarily speaking about my own university, but sometimes people who are vetting really don't know what they're looking at. You know, Iran, for example, has some of the best engineering programs in the world, you know, in terms of higher education. But a person who's not trained in that and doesn't know that wouldn't know how to properly vet a CV from Iran.
Exactly. Sort of the, you know, there's a problem of globalization, right? People are moving, and I guess sometimes people move faster than knowledge does.
Well, let's dig in more, if you will, to the, because there's so, the Cold War period, the post-World War II movement, and its consequences for comparative education. There's a few things now. Will has written several really brilliant pieces, and there's one I just recently read. Basically, it's Comparative Education as a Political Project, published as Comparative Education, yes. Excellent piece. And you mentioned some key moments. For example, the National Defense Education Act of 1958, right? An infamous education act. Do you want to pick up on that one, or maybe some other events within this period of time that had consequences for, or ramifications for, the field of comparative education, then had also reverberating consequences for minority groups?
The defense funding in education, you know, this is the sort of, Gita Steiner-Kamsey has written a lot about this, of course, and about this sort of Sputnik moment. So it's deeply involved in the Cold War, and it was all of a sudden the U.S. sort of lost the space race. It was like, oh my gosh, the Soviets have done this before us, and so therefore it became national priority because of sort of a national security issue to just inject a lot of money into schools and universities. And for those who don't know, the U.S. does not have a particularly strong federal system of funding, particularly for higher education. But even at school levels, it's much more done on a local basis or philanthropic basis and student fees. And so for the federal government to get involved in funding was this really big moment. You know, what came out of it are things like area studies. So the study of sort of the Soviet Union. So Sovietologists became a thing. I think the study of China eventually comes out of this too later on, which you still see in the U.S. system. But for the U.S. or for comparative education, what you do see is the beginnings of the field or comparative education society. One of the first things they do when William Brickman and Gerald Reed and Betty Kutz Goodwin, I think her name was, one of the first things they did was do a study trip to the USSR. Quite amazing, really, to take teachers from the US and travel to the USSR to sort of see what others are doing in terms of their education. And so that funding definitely sort of ignited the fire, let's say, or, you know, created the conditions under which comparative ed could institutionalize. And so it was hugely valuable in that sense. But of course, it was all premised on a very sort of, you know, like this Cold War ideologies. And so many academics had to write about what their ideas were, but sort of couched in that language. So Theodore Schultz, for instance, was anything you read by him in this period usually has something about, you know, the communists. And if you didn't signal that, you could actually get in a lot of trouble in the USA. So academics went to great lengths to sort of manage that. Now, how does that impact minority groups and indigenous communities? I mean, it's almost on, I mean, I'm sure in many ways, but the first thing that comes to my mind, sort of it focused so much attention on one thing, and it means it what other things weren't being focused on. You know, it was like COVID. COVID focused all of our attention on getting that vaccine, and we did, and it was great, and, you know, it took a huge effort. But we probably missed a lot of other things that were going on at that period too. And I think that's probably where we could think about the origins of comparative education. It just, our focus was so narrowed, and we might have missed other things. Not to say that everyone did. I'm sure people were writing interesting things, but we're sort of talking in the general here.
Yeah, and we're talking, you know, to coin a term that I don't hear a whole lot anymore, but I certainly heard it a lot in the 80s, you know, the dominant paradigm. Well, that was the dominant paradigm, right? Hmm. And dominant paradigms have ontological and epistemological commitments. And in a way, what I'm hearing is saying, like, kind of tracing back to our earlier discussion about indigenous ways of knowing or ways of knowing that are rooted in very particular epistemologies, they're shut out from that logic. That logic doesn't speak to them. I'm thinking about some of my own graduate school experiences because I went to an urban university for my master's degree, and there were many at the time. I'm like, you know, born and raised in Wisconsin, and then, you know, I was in Chicago. It was the first time I was really exposed to and living amongst and with a much larger and more realistic swath of the populace. And many of my fellow graduate students were African American, and they were talking about the Black experience. And like, it, as a neophyte, you know, I couldn't see where they were coming from. I was thinking, I was kind of all charged up in neo-Marxist terms, and I was thinking about class warfare, and I was like, why are you all, you keep talking about race? But later on, I was humbled myself in a way to reimagine, like, well, this is a world lived in a particular ontological and epistemological space. You have to be attentive to which paradigms are allowing for that and which aren't. So I could see certainly there must have been so many struggles that were not being listened to or didn't have the kind of microphone, if you will, at that period of time. Yeah.
And, you know, you bringing up race is a really interesting issue. It reminds me of an interview I did with Francine Menashe and Zina Zakaria about sort of white ignorance in the global education policy space. And they're not talking about it at the time you were doing your grad programs, right? They're talking about it today. And they were looking at global institutions that work in education, which many of our graduate students end up working for. Many research projects we might be doing are connected to them. So they're very much sort of players in our field today. And what Francine and Zina basically show is that it's almost like they don't engage with like conversations on race, and it's not a lens through which they see the work they're doing. And, you know, it's hugely problematic.
Exactly. So in fact, you know, I think you said earlier that we're still living out our history, and this could be a trend that we, in some ways, we've inherited from the past. There's a lot we could dig into with the human capital revolution and also its ramifications, you know, structural adjustments, lending, and loan policies. I don't know if you want to go there right now and talk about contingency loans and the world.
I don't know if I want to go into that particularly. I mean, because I feel like so many people have talked about it. What one of the things that fascinates me in sort of roughly the same period, but maybe actually slightly before, sort of came just before the structural adjustments, was out of Chicago, what today we would call a university partnership, which is something that we're all supposed to, you know, cheer and do, and it's internationalization. And the University of Chicago did this with the Pontifical Catholic University in Chicago, PUC, in Chile. And so the PUC in Chile had this partnership with the University of Chicago and their economics departments. And the University of Chicago trained basically, you know, all of the staff at PUC in the end. You know, I think it was like 12 out of 13 of the economists that worked in the faculty were trained at the University of Chicago. And Chicago had this long-standing relationship, many years funded by Ford Foundation and Rockefeller Foundation, part of the U.S. engagement in sort of South America, Latin America, also part of this sort of Cold War, trying to like get cozy with people that would be anti-communist. And so what's interesting is that that group of Chicago-trained economists was basically the ones who wrote the economic blueprint for when Pinochet came to power in the 70s after the coup against Allende, the socialist. And you can see that if you look at what that blueprint says on education, it's like human capital to a T. It's really quite amazing. And then if you fast forward, you can see things like the massive student protests in Chile against that system in the 2000s. And even someone like Gabriel Boric, who's the current president of Chile, he was actually a student union leader, right? He was leading these student protests in the 2010s. And so what was coming out of the University of Chicago, the way in which they were using economic reasoning for everything and how that influenced education thinking. Chile is like a perfect example of this because it sort of, they embraced it completely through a pretty sort of serious general who was, you know, murdering people and disappearing people left and right. But the long story of it is that the reaction came and that students were protesting against what we would today call privatization. And it sort of set the trajectory of Chile for, you know, this century, basically.
It's a great, I think, case study in a way, a great episode to learn from. There's a lot packed in there. I'm glad that you're bringing our readers back to that period of time. So you see there the work of eventually or maybe unwittingly marginalizing a very large swath of the population. And therein, I think, is part of the link that we're looking for here. How does the kind of myopic and paradigmatic focus on human capital theory simultaneously work to marginalize large swaths of the population? Mm-hmm. And that was, I mean, the proof's in the pudding in a way. It was, you could see that in high drama. I do have a question I want to cycle back to. So at the beginning of the interview, you said something that, I don't want to use the word provocative, but it really stuck for me. I think you suggested, Will, that there, because of the, you know, decolonizing the curriculum right now, it has become very rather fashionable. Mm-hmm. It's a trend right now. But you also seem to sort of demarcate what it actually means to decolonize the curriculum versus what it sort of maybe superficially means. And I wonder if you could tell our readers, what does it really mean to decolonize the curriculum? And in doing so, what does it really mean to give authenticity to, let's say, indigenous knowledges or non-dominant paradigm ways of knowing, if you want to cast it in a bit larger terms?
It's a really fraught area to think through, particularly, you know, I would say two white men trying to talk about this that sort of were deeply privileged from the system that is so exploitative. We were sort of the winners of it, right? We benefited from it. So it's really hard for us to now come back and sort of say, this is how we should do it. But I think the point being is that it's a lot of it has to be about giving up power. It has to be about saying, you know what? I'm not the one who can do it or should do it. And I'm going to step out of the way and let someone do it. Or, you know, I'm going to give up power. And that's the hard part. And that's where it doesn't come in. And that's where, it's much easier to sort of have a celebration of multicultural food. You know, that's a much easier thing to do. Or to add one article on your syllabus that is from a, you know, an indigenous scholar, which, okay, that good first step, but, you know, clearly not enough. I also think, is it Sarah Ahmed who always says about who you cite in your articles? And, you know, that's something that all of us can actually, all of us scholars who have sort of writing is something we do, who we cite, there's a lot of power in that. And we should be citing, you know, people that don't just sort of perpetuate that same canon of thinking. And to do that means we have to then engage with work that might be outside of what we normally engage with, what we were taught in our grad programs. And I think that begins to have a bit of a, you know, a deeper conversation about where we might go. But exactly what that looks like or where we end up going, I don't know. I mean, I don't think we can start this process knowing the endpoint.
And there might not be one. And that's something like Charles Taylor writes about this with multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is a work in progress, maybe forever. And perhaps maybe we need to adopt a more process-oriented approach towards looking at decolonization.
And I would say we have to accept there's a politics to it, right? That there is a distribution of power, and it will have to mean some people giving up power. And that doesn't happen easily, and there will be a struggle. And if we don't recognize the politics of that, then I think we're not really going to get to the heart of what's happening, you know, of why the academic space looks the way it does.
Now, when you say giving up power, I know that you mean in part from in terms of reworking the canon or diversifying the canon. Mm. Do you also mean that from a pedagogical point? Do you also mean that as the guy behind the podium in your classes?
Yeah, to some extent, you know, to not necessarily have the answers or, you know, to listen is usually a big one. Since moving to Australia, I've been learning a lot about very different ways of sort of thinking and being. One of my colleagues here, David Spillman, he uses the phrase country as teacher. And so really embracing sort of the non-human side of learning and understanding. And so valuing country as much as we value the human mind is a first step. And for me, it's really hard to do because I don't have that same relationship with country someone like David Spillman does. And so, yeah, for me, it's a big education, right? That's something I'm sort of going through. But that can easily be woven into classes, the way you teach, the way you lecture, what you read, what you assign, but then perhaps also what you produce, how you relate to one another, how you, you know, giving up power is also about thinking around, you know, thinking about why do we value things like Q1 publications so much in academic promotions and the structures that exist in university. Why is it that the written form is the thing that is so valuable? Whereas, you know, people have learned through storytelling for most of history. You know, the Q1 journal article is rather new. So giving up some of those beliefs, or at least starting to question some of those beliefs that we put so much power into, I think can start allowing the academy to sort of begin to reimagine what it is or is not.
I can see that. I just read the editorial of the new incoming editorial team for Comparative Education Review. Much of what you're speaking about was written about in that editorial by our flagship journal. So that's a positive sign.
I absolutely agree with you. I think it's such a big sign. And, you know, the editors clearly took a big risk. I'm sure there might have been pushback on along the way there, but, you know, kudos to them. And I hope they can live up to that sort of mission that they set out. And I will, as, you know, as much as I can, support them along the way. Yeah, it's a refreshing vision to read.
It certainly was interesting to read that within a Comparative Education Review. I think that's all I have for questions. Do you have other summative thoughts or other stories you'd like to share with us?
I just think, you know, what I think or what I love reading in comparative ed are people who take sort of counterintuitive takes and stances on things. And they take what seemingly is so normal and show how it's rather complex or not the whole thing you see. And I think one way of doing that is actually, like, in a sense, a lot of the communities your journal is focusing in on, those people are in a really good position to do a lot of that because they can sort of call out the things that seemingly are so taken for granted in the sort of academic space, let's say. If we continue to focus in on the academic space or comparative education as a field, I think sort of starting, let's call it the periphery, starting from the periphery is actually a really valuable way to understand and critique what's going on in the sort of metropole.
Yes, yeah, nice way of summarizing that. And I will say that I'm very proud that Diaspora Indigenous Minority Education has always been doing this. We've been sort of that quiet journal that has been, from as long as I've been editor and even before, was already publishing works by folks in the Global South, by Indigenous scholars, for sure, for sure. In fact, I'd say more than half of our pieces on, in any given issue are from representatives of said communities. It's just that we didn't really wear it on our shirt sleeve. We just went ahead and went about our business and did this. And now it's become this big thing. But great. So we'll continue.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, more power to you. It's those types of journals that we really need to be leaning into as a field.
Well, we are happy then to have you as an interviewee, our honored guest within our conversation series. Such a privilege to interview Will Brehm on his own show.
Thank you so much, Bruce. That was me talking with Bruce Collette, a professor at Bowling Green State University and editor of Diaspora, Indigenous, and Minority Education, the journal where this conversation will appear soon. Please note that opinions expressed on Fresh Ed are solely those of the host or the guest interviewed, not Fresh Ed, which takes no institutional position. If you've liked what you've heard today, please rate us wherever you listen to podcasts. Reviews really do help. Fresh Ed's team includes Fatih Oktus, Obafemi Ongunle, Phyllis Che Mensah, Jose Neto, and Sabrina Matiri. Original music for Fresh Ed was created by Digital Primate. Fresh Ed is an independently run podcast without advertisements and is made possible by the support of NORAG, the Shocked Family Fund, and listeners like you. Please consider donating to Fresh Ed by visiting freshedpodcast.com/donate. Thanks for listening. I'm Will Brehm, and I'll be back next week.